The Handmaid's Tale, Cassette 8.
Today there are different flowers, drier, more defined, the flowers of high summer, daisies, black-eyed Susans, starting us on the long downward slope to fall. I see them in the gardens as I walk with Aughtglen to and fro. I hardly listen to her. I no longer credit her. The things she whispers seem to me unreal. What use are they for me now? You could go to his room at night, she says. Look through his desk. There must be papers, notations. The door is locked, I murmur. We could get you a key, she says. Don't you want to know who he is, what he does? But the commander is no longer of immediate interest to me. I have to make an effort to keep my indifference toward him from showing. Keep on doing everything exactly the way you were before, Nick says. Don't change anything. Otherwise, they'll know. He kisses me, watching me all the time. Promise? Don't slip up. I put his hand on my belly. It's happened, I say. I feel it has. A couple of weeks and I'll be certain. This, I know, is wishful thinking. He'll love you to death, he says. So will she. But it's yours, I say. It will be yours, really. I want it to be. We don't pursue this often. I can't, I say to Aughtglen. I'm too afraid. Anyway, I'd be no good at it. I'd get caught. I scarcely take the trouble to sound regretful, so lazy have I become. We could get you out, she says. We can get people out if we really have to, if they're in danger, immediate danger. The fact is that I no longer want to leave, escape, cross the border to freedom. I want to be here with Nick, where I can get at him. Telling this, I'm ashamed of myself. But there's more to it than that. Even now, I can recognize this admission as a kind of boasting. There's pride in it, because it demonstrates how extreme and therefore justified it was for me. How well worth it. It's like stories of illness and near death, from which you have recovered, like stories of war, they demonstrate seriousness. Such seriousness, about a man then, had not seemed possible to me before. Some days, I was more rational. I did not put it to myself in terms of love. I said, I have made a life for myself here of a sort. That must have been what the settlers' wives thought, and the women who survived wars if they had a man. Humanity is so adaptable, my mother would say. Truly amazing what people can get used to, as long as there are a few compensations. It won't be long now, says Cora, doling out my monthly stack of sanitary napkins. Not long now, smiling at me shyly but also knowingly. Does she know? Do she and Rita know what I'm up to creeping down their stairs at night? Do I give myself away, daydreaming, smiling at nothing, touching my face lightly when I think they aren't watching? Aughtglen is giving up on me. She whispers less, talks more about the weather. I do not feel regret about this. I feel relief. 42. The bell is tolling. We can hear it from a long way off. It's morning, and today we've had no breakfast. When we reach the main gate, we file through it two by two. There's a heavy contingent of guards, special detail angels with riot gear, the helmets with the bulging dark plexiglass visors that make them look like beetles, the long clubs, the gas canister guns, in cordon around the outside of the wall. That's in case of hysteria. The hooks on the wall are empty. This is a district salvaging for women only. Salvagings are always segregated. It was announced yesterday. They tell you only the day before. It's not enough time to get used to it. To the tolling of the bell, we walk along the paths once used by students, past buildings that were once lecture halls and dormitories. It's very strange to be in here again. From the outside, you can't tell that anything's changed. except that the blinds on most of the windows are drawn down. These buildings belong to the eyes now. We file onto the wide lawn in front of what used to be the library. The white steps going up are still the same. The main entrance is unaltered. There's a wooden stage erected on the lawn, something like the one they used every spring for commencement in the time before. I think of hats, pastel hats worn by some of the mothers, and of the black gowns the students would put on, and the red ones. But this stage is not the same after all, because of the three wooden posts that stand on it with the loops of rope. At the front of the stage there is a microphone. The television camera is discreetly off to the side. I've only been to one of these before, 2 years ago. Women's salvagings are not frequent. There is less need for them. These days we are so well behaved. I don't want to be telling this story. We take our places in the standard order, wives and daughters on the folding wooden chairs placed toward the back, Econo wives and Marthas around the edges and on the library steps, and handmaids at the front where everyone can keep an eye on us. We don't sit on chairs, but kneel, and this time we have cushions, small red velvet ones with nothing written on them, not even faith. Luckily, the weather is all right, not too hot, cloudy bright. It would be miserable kneeling here in the rain. Maybe that's why they leave it so late to tell us, so they'll know what the weather will be like. Oh, that's as good a reason as any. I kneel on my red velvet cushion. I try to think about tonight, about making love in the dark and the light reflected off the white walls. I remember being held. There's a long piece of rope that winds like a snake in front of the first row of cushions, along the second and back through the lines of chairs, bending like a very old, very slow river viewed from the air, down to the back. The rope is thick and brown and smells of tar. The front end of the rope runs up onto the stage. It's like a fuse or the string of a balloon. On the stage to the left are those who are to be salvaged. Two handmaids, one wife. Wives are unusual, and despite myself, I look at this one with interest. I want to know what she has done. They have been placed here before the gates were opened. All of them sit on folding wooden chairs, like graduating students who are about to be given prizes. Their hands rest in their laps, looking as if they are folded sedately. They sway a little. They've probably been given injections or pills, so they won't make a fuss. It's better if things go smoothly. Are they attached to their chairs? Impossible to say under all that drapery. Now the official procession is approaching the stage, mounting the steps at the right. Three women, one aunt in front, two salvagers in their black hoods and cloaks, a pace behind her. Behind them are the other ants. The whisperings among us hush. The three arrange themselves, turn toward us, the ant flanked by the two black-robed salvagers. It's Aunt Lydia. How many years since I've seen her? I'd begun to think she existed only in my head, but here she is, a little older. I have a good view. I can see the deepening furrows. To either side of her nose, the engraved frown. Her eyes blink. She smiles nervously, peering to left and right, checking out the audience, and lifts a hand to fidget with her headdress. An odd, strangling sound comes over the PA system. She is clearing her throat. I've begun to shiver. Hatred fills my mouth like spit. The sun comes out, and the stage and its occupants light up like a Christmas creche. I can see the wrinkles under Aunt Lydia's eyes, the pallor of the seated women, the hairs on the rope in front of me on the grass, the blades of grass. There is a dandelion right in front of me, the color of an egg yolk. I feel hungry. The bell stops tolling. Aunt Lydia stands up, smooths down her skirt with both hands and steps forward to the mic. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says, and there's an instant and ear-splitting feedback whine from the PA system. From among us, incredibly, there is laughter. It's hard not to laugh. It's the tension and the look of irritation on Aunt Lydia's face as she adjusts the sound. This is supposed to be dignified. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says again, her voice now tinny and flattened. It's ladies instead of girls because of the wives. "I'm sure we are all aware of the unfortunate circumstances that bring us all here together on this beautiful morning, when I am certain we would all rather be doing something else, at least I speak for myself, but duty is a hard task, master. Or may I say on this occasion, task, mistress, and it is in the name of duty that we are here today." She goes on like this for some minutes, but I don't listen. I've heard this speech, or one like it, often enough before. The same platitudes, the same slogans, the same phrases. The torch of the future, the cradle of the race, the task before us. It's hard to believe there will not be polite clapping after this speech, and tea and cookies served on the lawn. That was the prologue, I think. Now she'll get down to it. Aunt Lydia rummages in her pocket, produces a crumpled piece of paper. This she takes an undue length of time to unfold and scan. She's rubbing our noses in it, letting us know exactly who she is, making us watch her as she silently reads, flaunting her prerogative. Obscene, I think. Let's get this over with. "In the past," says Aunt Lydia, "it has been the custom to precede the actual salvagings with a detailed account of the crimes of which the prisoners stand convicted. However, we have found that such a public account, especially when televised, is invariably followed by a rash, if I may call it that, an outbreak, I should say, of exactly similar crimes. So we have decided, in the best interests of all, to discontinue this practice. The salvagings will proceed without further ado." A collective murmur goes up from us. The crimes of others are a secret language among us. Through them we show ourselves what we might be capable of after all. This is not a popular announcement. But you would never know it from Aunt Lydia, who smiles and blinks, as if washed in applause. Now we are left to our own devices, our own speculations. The first one, the one they're now raising from her chair, black-gloved hands on her upper arms. Reading? No, that's only a hand cut off on the third conviction. Unchastity? Or an attempt on the life of her commander? Or the commander's wife, more likely. That's what we're thinking. As for the wife, there's mostly just one thing they get salvaged for. They can do almost anything to us, but they aren't allowed to kill us. Not legally. Not with knitting needles or garden shears or knives purloined from the kitchen. And especially not when we are pregnant. It could be adultery, of course. It could always be that. Or attempted escape. "Of Charles," Aunt Lydia announces. No one I know. The woman is brought forward. She walks as if she's really concentrating on it. One foot, the other foot. She's definitely drugged. There's a groggy, off-center smile on her mouth. One side of her face contracts. An uncoordinated wink aimed at the camera. They'll never show it, of course. This isn't live. The two salvagers tie her hands behind her back. From behind me there's a sound of retching. That's why we don't get breakfast. "Janine, most likely," Av Glenn whispers. I've seen it before. The white bag placed over the head. The woman helped up onto the high stool as if she's being helped up the steps of a bus, steadied there, the noose adjusted delicately around the neck like a vestment, the stool kicked away. I've heard the long sigh go up from around me, the sigh like air coming out of an air mattress. I've seen Aunt Lydia place her hand over the mic to stifle the other sounds coming from behind her. I've leaned forward to touch the rope in front of me, in time with the others, both hands on it, the rope hairy, sticky with tar in the hot sun, then placed my hand on my heart to show my unity with the salvagers and my consent and my complicity in the death of this woman. I have seen the kicking feet and the two in black who now seize hold of them and drag downward with all their weight. I don't want to see it anymore. I look at the grass instead. I describe the rope. 43. The three bodies hang there, even with the white sacks over their heads, looking curiously stretched, like chickens strung up by the necks in a meat shop window, like birds with their wings clipped, like flightless birds, wrecked angels. It's hard to take your eyes off them. Beneath the hems of the dresses, the feet dangle, two pairs of red shoes, one pair of blue. If it weren't for the ropes and the sacks, it could be a kind of dance, a ballet caught by flash camera, mid-air. They look arranged. They look like showbiz. It must have been Aunt Lydia who put the blue one in the middle. Today's salvaging is now concluded, Aunt Lydia announces into the mic. But we turn to her, listen to her, watch her. She has always known how to space her pauses. A ripple runs over us, a stir. Something else, perhaps, is going to happen. But you may stand up and form a circle. She smiles down upon us, generous, munificent. She is about to give us something. Bestow. Orderly now. She is talking to us, to the handmaids. Some of the wives are leaving now, some of the daughters. Most of them stay, but they stay behind out of the way. They watch merely. They are not part of the circle. Two guardians have moved forward and are coiling up the thick rope, getting it out of the way. Others move the cushions. We are milling around now on the grass space in front of the stage, some jockeying for position at the front next to the center, many pushing just as hard to work their way to the middle where they will be shielded. It's a mistake to hang back too obviously in any group like this. It stamps you as lukewarm, lacking in zeal. There's an energy building here, a murmur, a tremor of readiness and anger. The body's tense, the eyes are brighter as if aiming. I don't want to be at the front, or at the back either. I'm not sure what's coming, though I sense it won't be anything I want to see up close. But Avglen has hold of my arm, she tugs me with her, and now we're in the second line with only a thin hedge of bodies in front of us. I don't want to see, yet I don't want to pull back either. I've heard rumors, which I only half believed. Despite everything I already know, I say to myself, they wouldn't go that far. You know the rules for a participation, Aunt Lydia says. You will wait until I blow the whistle. After that, what you do is up to you until I blow the whistle again. Understood? A noise comes from among us, a formless assent. Well then, says Aunt Lydia. She nods. Two guardians, not the same ones that have taken away the rope, come forward now from behind the stage. Between them, they half carry, half drag a third man. He too is in a guardian's uniform, but he has no hat on, and the uniform is dirty and torn. His face is cut and bruised. Deep reddish-brown bruises, and the flesh is swollen and knobby, stubbled with unshaven beard. This doesn't look like a face, but like an unknown vegetable, a mangled bulb or tuber, something that's gone wrong. Even from where I'm standing, I can smell him. He smells of shit and vomit. His hair is blonde and falls over his face, spiky with what? Dried sweat? He looks drunk. He looks like a drunk that's been in a fight. Why have they brought a drunk in here? This man, says Aunt Lydia, has been convicted of rape. Her voice trembles with rage and a kind of triumph. He was once a guardian. He has disgraced his uniform. He has abused his position of trust. His partner in viciousness has already been shot. The penalty for rape, as you know, is death. Deuteronomy 22:23-29. I might add that this crime involved two of you and took place at gunpoint. It was all so brutal. I will not offend your ears with any details except to say that one woman was pregnant and the baby died. A sigh goes up from us. Despite myself, I feel my hands clench. It is too much, this violation. The baby, too, after what we go through. It's true, there is a bloodlust. I want to tear, gouge, rend. We jostle forward. Our heads turn from side to side. Our nostrils flare, sniffing death. We look at one another, seeing the hatred. Shooting was too good. The man's head swivels groggily around. Has he even heard her? Aunt Lydia waits a moment. Then she gives a little smile and raises her whistle to her lips. We hear it, shrill and silver, an echo from a volleyball game of long ago. The two guardians let go of the third man's arms and step back. He staggers. Is he drugged? And falls to his knees. His eyes are shriveled up inside the puffy flesh of his face, as if the light is too bright for him. They've kept him in darkness. He raises one hand to his cheek, as though to feel if he is still there. All this happens quickly, but it seems to be slowly. Nobody moves forward. The women are looking at him with horror, as if he's a half-dead rat dragging itself across a kitchen floor. He's squinting around at us, the circle of red women. One corner of his mouth moves up. Incredible. A smile? I try to look inside him, inside the trashed face, see what he must really look like. I think he's about 30. It isn't Luke. But it could have been, I know that. It could be Nick. I know that whatever he's done, I can't touch him. He says something. It comes out thick, as if his throat is bruised, his tongue huge in his mouth. But I hear it anyway. He says, "I didn't." There's a surge forward, like a crowd at a rock concert in the former time when the doors opened, that urgency coming like a wave through us. The air is bright with adrenaline. We are permitted anything, and this is freedom, in my body also. I'm reeling. Red spreads everywhere, but before that tide of cloth and bodies hits him, Ogden is shoving through the women in front of us, propelling herself with her elbows, left, right, and running toward him. She pushes him down, sideways, then kicks his head viciously, one, two, three times. Sharp, painful jabs with the foot, well aimed. Now there are sounds, gasps, a low noise like growling, yells, and the red bodies tumble forward and I can no longer see. He's obscured by arms, fists, feet. A high scream comes from somewhere like a horse in terror. I keep back, try to stay on my feet. Something hits me from behind. I stagger. When I regain my balance and look around, I see the wives and daughters leaning forward in their chairs, the aunts on the platform gazing down with interest. They must have a better view from up there. He has become an it. Ogden is back beside me. Her face is tight, expressionless. "I saw what you did," I say to her. Now I'm beginning to feel again shock, outrage, nausea, barbarism. "Why did you do that? You, I thought you..." "Don't look at me," she says. "They're watching." "I don't care. I say. My voice is rising. I can't help it. Get control of yourself, she says. She pretends to brush me off, my arm and shoulder, bringing her face close to my ear. Don't be stupid. He wasn't a rapist at all. He was a political. He was one of ours. I knocked him out, put him out of his misery. Don't you know what they're doing to him? One of ours, I think. A guardian. It seems impossible. Aunt Lydia blows her whistle again, but they don't stop at once. The two guardians move in, pulling them off from what's left. Some lie on the grass where they've been hit or kicked by accident. Some have fainted. They straggle away in twos and threes or by themselves. They seem dazed. You will find your partners and reform your line, Aunt Lydia says into the mic. Few pay attention to her. A woman comes toward us, walking as if she's feeling her way with her feet in the dark. Janine. There's a smear of blood across her cheek, and more of it on the white of her headdress. She's smiling, a bright, diminutive smile. Her eyes have come loose. Hi there, she says. How are you doing? She's holding something tightly in her right hand. It's a clump of blonde hair. She gives a small giggle. Janine, I say. But she's let go totally now. She's in free fall. She's in withdrawal. You have a nice day, she says, and walks on past us toward the gate. I look after her. Easy out is what I think. I don't even feel sorry for her, although I should. I feel angry. I'm not proud of myself for this, or for any of it. But then, that's the point. My hands smell of warm tar. I want to go back to the house and up to the bathroom and scrub with the harsh soap and the pumice to get every trace of this smell off my skin. The smell makes me feel sick. But also, I'm hungry. This is monstrous, but nevertheless it's true. Death makes me hungry. Maybe it's because I've been emptied. Or maybe it's the body's way of seeing to it that I remain alive, continue to repeat its bedrock prayer. I am, I am. I am still. I want to go to bed, make love right now. I think of the word relish. I could eat a horse. 44. Things are back to normal. How can I call this normal? But compared with this morning, it is normal. For lunch, there was a cheese sandwich on brown bread, a glass of milk, celery sticks, canned pears, a school child's lunch. I ate everything up, not quickly, but reveling in the taste, the flavors lush on my tongue. Now I'm going shopping the same as usual. I even look forward to it. There's a certain consolation to be taken from routine. I go out the back door along the path. Nick is washing the car, his hat on sideways. He doesn't look at me. We avoid looking at each other these days. Surely we'd give something away by it, even out here in the open with no one to see. I wait at the corner for Avglen. She's late. At last I see her coming, a red and white shape of cloth like a kite, walking at the steady pace we've all learned to keep. I see her and notice nothing at first. Then, as she comes nearer, I think that there must be something wrong with her. She looks wrong. She's altered in some indefinable way. She's not injured. She's not limping. It's as if she has shrunk. Then, when she's nearer still, I see what it is. She isn't Avglen. She's the same height but thinner, and her face is beige, not pink. She comes up to me, stops. Blessed be the fruit, she says, straight-faced, straight-laced. May the Lord open, I reply. I try not to show surprise. You must be Alfred, she says. I say yes, and we begin our walk. Now what, I think. My head is churning. This is not good news. What has become of her? How do I find out without showing too much concern? We aren't supposed to form friendships, loyalties among one another. I try to remember how much time Avglen has to go at her present posting. We've been sent good weather, I say, which I receive with joy, the voice placid, flat, unrevealing. We pass the first checkpoint without saying anything further. She is taciturn, but so am I. Is she waiting for me to start something, reveal myself, or is she a believer engrossed in inner meditation? Has Avglen been transferred so soon? I ask. But I know she hasn't. I saw her only this morning. She would have said. I am Avglen, the woman says. Word perfect. And of course she is, the new one. And Avglen, wherever she is no longer Avglen. I never did know her real name. That is how you get lost, in a sea of names. It wouldn't be easy to find her now. We go to Milk and Honey and to All Flesh, where I buy a chicken and the new Avglen gets 3 pounds of hamburger. There are the usual lines. I see several women I recognize, exchange with them the infinitesimal smiles with which we show each other we are known, at least to someone, we still exist. Outside All Flesh, I say to the new Avglen, we should go to the wall. I don't know what I expect from this, some way of testing her reaction, perhaps. I need to know whether or not she is one of us. If she is, if I can establish that, perhaps she'll be able to tell me what has really happened to Avglen. As you like, she says. Is that indifference or caution? On the wall hang the 3 women from this morning, still in their dresses, still in their shoes, still with the white bags over their heads. Their arms have been untied and are stiff and proper at their sides. The blue one is in the middle, the 2 red ones on either side, though the colors are no longer as bright. They seem to have faded, grown dingy like dead butterflies or tropical fish drying on land. The gloss is off them. We stand and look at them in silence. Let that be a reminder to us, says the new Avglen finally. I say nothing at first because I'm trying to make out what she means. She could mean that this is a reminder to us of the unjustness and the brutality of the regime. In that case, I ought to say yes. Or she could mean the opposite. That we should remember to do what we are told and not get into trouble, because if we do, we will be rightfully punished. If she means that, I should say, praise be. Her voice was bland, toneless, no clues there. I take a chance. Yes, I say. To this she does not respond, although I sense a flicker of white at the edge of my vision, as if she's looked quickly at me. After a moment, we turn away and begin the long walk back, matching our steps in the approved way so that we seem to be in unison. I think maybe I should wait before attempting anything further. It's too soon to push, to probe. I should give it a week, 2 weeks, maybe longer. Guard her carefully. Listen for tones in her voice, unguarded words, the way Avglen listened to me. Now that Avglen is gone, I am alert again. My sluggishness has fallen away. My body is no longer for pleasure only, but senses its jeopardy. I should not be rash. I should not take unnecessary risks. But I need to know. I hold back until we're past the final checkpoint, and there are only blocks to go, but then I can no longer control myself. I didn't know Avglen very well, I say. I mean the former one. Oh, she says. The fact that she said anything, however guarded, encourages me. I've only known her since May, I say. I can feel my skin growing hot, my heart speeding up. This is tricky. For one thing, it's a lie. And how do I get from there to the next vital word? around the 1st of May, I think it was, what they used to call May Day. Did they? She says, light, indifferent, menacing. That isn't a term I remember. I'm surprised you do. You ought to make an effort, she pauses, to clear your mind of such. She pauses again, echoes. Now I feel cold, seeping over my skin like water. What she is doing is warning me. She isn't one of us, but she knows. I walk the last blocks in terror. I've been stupid again, more than stupid. It hasn't occurred to me before, but now I see if Ogglen's been caught, Ogglen may talk about me, among others. She will talk. She won't be able to help it. But I haven't done anything, I tell myself. Not really. All I did was know. All I did was not tell. They know where my child is. What if they bring her, threaten something to her in front of me, or do it? I can't bear to think what they might do. Or Luke. What if they have Luke? Or my mother, or Maura, or almost anyone? Dear God, don't make me choose. I would not be able to stand it, I know that. Maura was right about me. I'll say anything they like. I'll incriminate anyone. It's true. The first scream, whimper even, and I'll turn to jelly. I'll confess to any crime. I'll end up hanging from a hook on the wall. Keep your head down, I used to tell myself, and see it through. It's no use. This is the way I talk to myself on the way home. At the corner, we turn to one another in the usual way. Under his eye, says the new treacherous Ogglen. Under his eye, I say, trying to sound fervent, as if such play-acting could help now that we've come this far. Then she does an odd thing. She leans forward so that the stiff white blinkers on our heads are almost touching, so that I can see her pale beige eyes up close, the delicate web of lines across her cheeks, and whispers very quickly, her voice faint as dry leaves. She hanged herself, she says, after the salvaging. She saw the van coming for her. It was better. Then she's walking away from me, down the street. 45. I stand a moment, emptied of air as if I'd been kicked. So she's dead, and I am safe after all. She did it before they came. I feel a great relief. I feel thankful to her. She has died that I may live. I will mourn later. Unless this woman is lying, there's always that. I breathe in deeply, breathe out, giving myself oxygen. The space in front of me blackens, then clears. I can see my way. I turn, open the gate, keeping my hand on it a moment to steady myself, walk in. Nick is there, still washing the car, whistling a little. He seems very far away. Dear God, I think, I will do anything you like. Now that you've let me off, I'll obliterate myself, if that's what you really want. I'll empty myself truly, become a chalice. I'll give up Nick. I'll forget about the others. I'll stop complaining. I'll accept my lot. I'll sacrifice. I'll repent. I'll abdicate. I'll renounce. I know this can't be right, but I think it anyway. Everything they taught us at the Red Center, everything I've resisted comes flooding in. I don't want pain. I don't want to be a dancer, my feet in the air, my head a faceless oblong of white cloth. I don't want to be a doll hung up on a wall. I don't want to be a wingless angel. I want to keep on living in any form. I resign my body freely to the uses of others. They can do what they like with me. I am abject. I feel, for the first time, their true power. I go along past the flower beds, the willow tree, aiming for the back door. I will go in. I will be safe. I will fall on my knees in my room, gratefully breathe in lungfuls of the stale air smelling of furniture polish. Serena Joy has come out of the front door. She's standing on the steps. She calls to me. What is it she wants? Does she want me to go into the sitting room and help her wind gray wool? I won't be able to hold my hand steady. She'll notice something. But I walk over to her anyway, since I have no choice. On the top step, she towers above me. Her eyes flare, hot blue against the shriveled white of her skin. I look away from her face, down at the ground, at her feet, the tip of her cane. I trusted you, she says. I tried to help you. Still, I don't look up at her. Guilt pervades me. I've been found out, but for what? For which of my many sins am I accused? The only way to find out is to keep silent. To start excusing myself now for this or that would be a blunder. I could give away something she hasn't even guessed. It might be nothing. It might be the match hidden in my bed. I hang my head. Well, she says. Nothing to say for yourself? I look up at her. About what? I manage to stammer. As soon as it's out, it sounds impudent. Look, she says. She brings her free hand from behind her back. It's her cloak she's holding, the winter one. There was lipstick on it, she says. How could you be so vulgar? I told him... She drops the cloak. She's holding something else, her hand all bone. She throws that down as well. The purple sequins fall, slithering down over the step like snakeskin, glittering in the sunlight. Behind my back, she says. You could have left me something. Does she love him after all? She raises her cane. I think she's going to hit me, but she doesn't. Pick up that disgusting thing and get to your room, just like the other one. A slut. You'll end up the same. I stoop, gather. Behind my back, Nick has stopped whistling. I want to turn, run to him, throw my arms around him. This would be foolish. There is nothing he can do to help. He too would drown. I walk to the back door, into the kitchen, set down my basket, go upstairs. I am orderly and calm. Night 46. I sit in my room at the window waiting. In my lap is a handful of crumpled stars. This could be the last time I have to wait, but I don't know what I'm waiting for. What are you waiting for? They used to say. That meant hurry up. No answer was expected. For what are you waiting is a different question, and I have no answer for that one either. Yet it isn't waiting exactly. It's more like a form of suspension without suspense. At last, there is no time. I am in disgrace, which is the opposite of grace. I ought to feel worse about it, but I feel serene, at peace, pervaded with indifference. Don't let the bastards grind you down. I repeat this to myself, but it conveys nothing. You might as well say, don't let there be air, or don't be. I suppose you could say that. There's nobody in the garden. I wonder if it will rain. Outside, the light is fading. It's reddish already. Soon it will be dark. Right now, it's darker. That didn't take long. There are a number of things I could do. I could set fire to the house, for instance. I could bundle up some of my clothes and the sheets and strike my one hidden match. If it didn't catch, that would be that. But if it did, there would at least be an event, a signal of some kind to mark my exit, a few flames easily put out. In the meantime, I could let loose clouds of smoke and die by suffocation.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 from the same point.